Good morning and welcome to Health Styles. I'm Dr. Kenya Beard, one of the co-producers of this program that's brought to you by the Center for Health, Media, and Policy at Hunter College, the City University of New York. We are going to have an exciting show today on Health Styles. We are concluding our three-part series on why healthcare disparities exist. Our previous guests, Doctors Dana Bowen Matthews and Anil Haider, have reminded us that so much more has to be done to ensure that everyone receives the best quality of healthcare. Dana is currently looking at laws that might help, and Anil is knee-deep in studies that help to explain why healthcare providers do not always deliver optimal services. And today, we will be discussing the power of assumptions, things that we sometimes believe without having proof, and what we are learning from that. So all of us, you know, think about it. All of us have assumptions, and oftentimes these assumptions direct our behaviors, sometimes in a good way and sometimes in a destructive way. You know, we have been overwhelmed by the horrific and devastating effects of assumptions across the country. So, for example, before Eric Garner died from that brutal chokehold, the media reports that there was a delay in rendering first aid. What were the assumptions that guided the actions or guided the lack of actions of the police officers and the paramedics? Did they assume that he was faking? You know, if so, where did these assumptions come from? And more importantly, can we control them? Joining us today to help us answer these questions and discuss the powers of assumptions and what we are learning about them in healthcare is the courageous and talented Dr. Michelle Van Rijn. Michelle is an elite professor of health services research at the Mayo Clinic, Office of Health Disparities Research, and she studies the equity and quality of healthcare encounters. That means if you've ever felt that your healthcare provider treated you in a way that just wasn't right, it could have stemmed from a misguided assumption. Now, this could be dangerous because it could lead to some individuals being treated in a school system by teachers, in society by police officers, or in healthcare by our providers. We can be treated in a way that compromises our level of health. Michelle, welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
Michelle, I'm in awe of your research. And one of the things that I love, love, love most about what you do is that you are really trying to improve patient-provider encounters and ensure that everyone receives the best possible health care. So for that, thank you.
Well, as I said, there's so much work to do, and I thank you for your work.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I appreciate that. So to get started today, could you tell us first what are healthcare disparities and give us an example?
Well, at this point, there's probably over 900 studies, maybe even over 1,000 studies showing that Black patients in the United States and in some other countries, but I'll just focus on the United States, are less likely to get appropriate guideline concordant or cutting edge care than their white counterparts. And some of that is because of differences in insurance. So if you look at, you know, systematic discrimination can cause people to have lower paying jobs, less likely to have benefits. So that's a piece of it. Some of it is site of care. You know, where do you get your care? But even when you adjust for those factors and you look at what goes on with the same patients in the same healthcare system, Black patients are somewhat less likely to get the ideal care. So there's numerous studies. There's studies, for example, and I was interested in what you were just talking about the police, but there's studies on pain care, so less likely to get appropriate pain care for long bone fractures in the emergency room, you know, less likely to get aggressive treatment for cardiac diseases. So, you know, if you have heart disease, sometimes you really the best thing for you is to have coronary artery bypass graft surgery. It's, you know, it's pretty invasive. It's quite expensive. but sometimes it's the best. So black patients, though, have been shown in some of my work and many other people's work to be less likely to receive it, even though the all the algorithms, all the things that people set up to say who's appropriate for it show that they're appropriate for it and sometimes necessary.
Wow. So, you know, I'm black. So what frightens me and alarms me is that if I go into the emergency room with chest pain, knowing that I might not receive aggressive treatment because of my skin color, that really makes me sad. And it makes me, you know, really anxious about what are we doing and are we doing it quick enough to address this problem? So there are so many factors that play a role in healthcare disparities. You touched upon some, access and where you go for care. But what made you specifically decide to focus on patient-provider relationships?
I have to kind of, I guess I'm going to back up a little and say that I'm also a social psychologist. And one of the things that I have noticed about the healthcare discourse, right, around healthcare is that it wasn't being very well informed and still isn't very well informed by about 30 years of research looking at why whites who are consciously egalitarian, genuinely believe they are unprejudiced, are still perpetuating discriminatory actions. So there's a deep, deep body of literature on that, you know, about what's going on there. And so the reason I look at encounters is because that's where my strength is, right? Mm-hmm. Interaction, but also because there are what I would call it is sort of threats in the air. And Claude Steele actually coined that term to talk about identity threat, but unconscious or automatic biases are like they're an invisible actor. They're a threat in the air. We can create, you know, we could have universal health care where everybody gets to the best health care system, but until we address that issue, there's still going to be a problem. But there's something I want to say. First of all, I don't blame you for being concerned. It's extremely disturbing. What I would say, though, is this is what gets confusing. Most of the time, black patients and white patients get the same good or bad care, right? So sometimes everybody's not getting the great care. Mm-hmm. It's just that black patients are more likely. So over a large number of encounters, there's many, 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 many people not getting good care. But if you go into the emergency room, that doesn't mean that you in that specific time won't get good care. But there are things you can do to make it much more likely you'll get good care. And we can talk about that in a minute. So I focus on the encounter because pretty much, if you think about institutional racism or any other ism, most of them are kind of mediated or they're caused by, at some point, somebody interacting with someone else, somebody mm-hmm. making a decision about someone else. So at the policies themselves reflect the way that people think, right? So I feel as if it's a crucial, almost like looking at the atom, right? So, you know, try to understand a structure, yes, you know, you do, but sometimes you actually have to look at the way the atoms are coming together in the structure before you can rebuild it.
Oh, I like that analogy, how the atoms are coming together. And think about that before we rebuild it, because, you know, I always reference desegregation when I talk about diversity and healthcare disparities. And I reference desegregation because I felt that as a child of the 60s and going into school post-Civil Rights Act of 1964 and going into a school district where there were black students who were bused in to the school. I kind of, you know, look back and I can feel, I had a sense that the environment was not the best for black people, that some of the teachers had attitudes about us that I don't think were based on any hardcore evidence. I felt that they had stereotypes and assumptions, misguided assumptions, especially about our ability to learn. And, you know, when I reflect back on that and I think about, you know, desegregation, this is a great law, this is a great policy, but what did we do to the environment? Like you said, when these atoms come together, what did we do to make it so that the students would and the people who united student and teacher when they came together, it would be something positive that emerged. And the same thing with diversity. We're trying to strengthen diversity in healthcare, but now we have all of these different cultures coming together, and it could be the perfect storm for unrest, because unless we talk about our feelings and our beliefs and some of our unconscious biases, you know, we're not going to get what we intended through these different from these different policies.
Yes, we may get some, we'll get, you know, so I don't want to, we'll get some of what we intended. So, for example, when the Civil Rights Act was enacted, there was a big drop in infant mortality. So we'll get some of it, but there'll still be pieces there and pretty big pieces and experiences. But one of the things that I think makes it hard for people to kind of get this is that we don't really get how we actually interact with the world. We don't really understand our own brains. We believe that we are controlled by our conscious thoughts. But actually, we have at least two systems. One is this unconscious, automatic, very, very, very fast system. And so, you know, if you think about it, you know, like right now, you and I are doing a lot of things that we're not thinking about at all.
Right.
Controlled. So I'm sitting. I'm facing the microphone on my phone. All of those things are because that system knows what I'm supposed to do, is telling me what I'm supposed to do, so I don't have to focus.
Mm-hmm.
So that system is really well elaborated in the social world, you know, because we're a social species, so we kind of live and die, and the way we live depends an awful lot about how we're accepted into our social world. So that part is elaborated, and what it does is it tries to, you know, it's not unmoral, it's not amoral, it's just an automatic survival mechanism that is obsolete now. So that system, a long, long time ago, classified people who don't look like us as out-group members, and people who look like us or seem like us as in-group members. And that the way that it classifies people now is extremely outdated. Now, presumably, you know, whatever. I mean, I'm not hundreds of thousands of years ago, that might have made sense. But now it doesn't. So what you need, so one of the things, if you go into, you know, you go to the emergency room, one of the goals is to get people to see you as you, Kenya, and not apply the group category. So for white people, a lot of times we spend, we spend most of our time around other white people. This is generally, and we see images, the dominant images that we see of our black colleagues, our black friends, our black coworkers is on TV, and it is portrayed poorly. So there's this automatic, this part of our brain is always making associations, right?
Mm-hmm.
A chair is for sitting. It's instant. So it's always looking for what can we associate with a given person? Like, what do I associate with a tall white man? You know, what do I associate? And it, because it wants to predict. It wants to help us negotiate our world. It wants
right.
to tell us what we need. It also tells us what to focus on. So that's another issue. So one of the problems is that if it classifies someone according to a group category, such as, you know, black or woman or a variety of other maybe potentially stigmatized social identities, it can automatically apply whatever it's been taught through repeated associations to associate with that, you know, to connect.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens is about 80%, 70 to 80% of white Americans automatically, regardless of their desire or their intent, you know, their true, genuine, I mean, this is genuine, egalitarian commitments and motives. Well, that part of our brains and everyone's brains automatically will really tragically connect black faces with negative associations. Now, it can be interrupted. It's not a sentence. You know, it's not like it has to happen.
Right.
But if we don't pay attention, it can happen. And the goal is always to create situations where people are experienced as unique individuals versus a representative of a group category. And when that happens, things get better.
So to help us as healthcare providers move towards that goal, to look at individuals as and individual, and to kind of dissociate ourselves from those unconscious biases, the groupings that we might, how we might categorize individuals. We started providing cultural competence training.
Yeah.
Now, do you find, or has your research informed you about the effectiveness of this training?
So I'm not a huge fan of cultural competence training in most of its forms, but of course I haven't seen what everyone is doing, so I can't. I'm not gonna sweep it all, you know, out the door, because it's impossible for me to have seen everything. And there might be people who are doing things that are pretty good, but that's not really. There are some problems with cultural competence training. So because those systems are automatic, the goal is to prevent ourselves from being hijacked by them. Sometimes cultural competence training just exacerbates this idea of seeing other people in terms of groups, right? So the worst kind of cultural competence training is one that tells you a lot about a given, you know, in Minnesota we have a lot of Somali immigrants. So, you know, I could get training that would say, tell me a lot about Somali culture and beliefs.
Right.
But when I see a young Somali woman, she may not believe in any of those things. If I'm automatically assuming that, it's just as bad, right?
For her. Right.
She has to kind of crawl her way out. The things that help, the things that will make a difference that really have been shown to help, first of all, do you want me to go into that now?
Sure, sure.
Okay.
Because we've spent a lot of money, you know, in healthcare regarding cultural competence training. Our textbooks are, you know, it's a huge emphasis in school, in the healthcare arena. So, and your thoughts are spot on with our prior guest as well. I know Dana Bowen-Matthew also spoke about cultural competence training, and she shared your perspective as well.
Yeah, the other problem that we always need to worry about, but we're seeing in organizations around the country, is it's not just that a lot of this training doesn't work because it's not really getting at the core issue, but it tends to make people complacent. Okay, we've been trained. And sometimes things actually get worse in organizations. So it's kind of, there's just this really hidden complex set of dynamics that we know about, and when I say we, it's people who will wade through all of that literature, right?
Mm-hmm.
But isn't getting well translated into actual practice. And actually, one of the things that I've done, because I can't stand just doing research anymore, I mean, I love research and it's important, but I set up a company called Partners in Equity and Inclusion, and our whole mission is to try to make sure that the evidence that we have about what works and what makes things worse, it starts to permeate what we're actually doing, so to kind of increase the reach. Because most people who are working in this area are not going to read the 10 studies that came out yesterday that have jargon in them, right?
Right.
So of course it's not getting permeating. So that's kind of as I get older, I can't just keep putting out more research and going around and talking. So right now I'm doing that as well. But I digress. So.
No, but congratulations for forming Partners of Equity and Inclusion. That's huge, and it's well needed.
Yeah, well, so, and then we're just trying to figure out how do we create a spread, and how do we create the maximum sort of diffusion or spread of the information that we have about why something, like, why is there so much white backlash? You know, what is actually happening, and why don't these interventions work? So there's a bunch of things you can do to the environment, and I'm focusing right now a lot on trying to create equity and inclusion, like true, deep, inclusive environments in mm-hmm. the healthcare organization. Because if you do that, you create the environment that's receptive to true equity and inclusion in the encounter. So for years, I was just focusing on giving providers or diffusing providers with skills to prevent themselves, or just practices, things they can do to prevent themselves from being hijacked, right?
Bam. Mm-hmm.
Now, that didn't address the conscious stuff, and we know it's out there, right?
Right.
But it was something to give people so that they could do their best, right, and to not be hijacked. And the skills work. So I'm not, you know, at all. I'm still doing it, still providing it, still training it. But if people are in an environment that is not inclusive, that has, you know, multiple, you know, many discriminatory events, sometimes called microaggressions, you know, multiple factors that exclude some individuals from fully showing up and feeling their best, it's going to be very hard to change patient care. So I have.
Well, I think it's also hard because, just going back to what you said, you know, when you're talking about an environment that's inclusive, there are members that are included and members who are not, who are actually excluded. So usually the ones who are excluded are very sensitive and they can sense that they've been excluded. But it's the ones who are included, especially if they're in the leadership positions and they hold the power, they are sometimes unaware of the behaviors and actions that make the environment not inclusive. So how do you raise awareness to that? Because I think our listeners, no matter where they work, who they are, white or black, young or old, all of us can relate to being excluded from some group, whether it's because of our sexual or orientation or our weight or our color of skin. So we know what that feels like. So what's your recommendation?
So I can tell you something that we've done here at Mayo Clinic. So, you know, Mayo Clinic being, you know, wanting to always be responsive to the very best evidence, when the leadership became aware that there might be things going on that's related to unconscious biases, that maybe that even though there's all this training on patient-centered care and putting the patient first, that possibly there could be something, they became supportive of us doing a system-wide diversity climate assessment. So with my partners here, you know, the Sharon Hayes, who's the director of the Office of Diversity and Inclusion, and Fred Wills, who's a partner, there's just a lot of players here. But my research program within Mayo, the research program on equity and inclusion in healthcare, we conducted a full climate assessment. And we are right now providing the feedback to the Board of Governors and to the leadership, along with some targeted recommendations. And what happens is, when you are included, the exclusion of others is invisible. So you need to make it visible. And one of the ways to make it visible is through assessments with large numbers. Because otherwise what happens, and I'm guessing, you're a nurse, yes?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing you've experienced this. People have experiences of events that are, you know, small and big, discriminatory events, right? They're not being, their ideas aren't quite picked up on, they're not getting as much eye contact, people don't talk to them as much, you know, all the way to dismissiveness, suspicion, all of the things that, you know, you've described. So people know it, but they're not, if they bring it up, just them, the concern is, quite realistically, that there's going to be a dismissiveness towards them. It's going to be attributed to something about them, and things will get worse.
Right.
And there is truth to that, because we're very, all of us humans are very motivated to think that everything's fine, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's so much easier. And I'm not saying this is evil. It's not. It's human. To just say, rather than, wow, there could be something really ugly happening here that I don't want to be happening here, it's so much easier to say, oh, this person is, you may have heard this, too sensitive.
Right. Well, definitely. And before we go on, I just want to remind our listeners that this is Health Styles, and I'm Dr. Kenya Beard, one of the co-producers of the show, and we have Dr. Michelle Van Ryn here from the Mayo Clinic joining us today to talk about implicit bias in healthcare and what we are learning. So, Michelle, you just talked about when some people are excluded, the people who are doing the exclusion or performing acts that are, you know, excluding others, it's invisible to them. And you recommended that we make it visible. And I guess that's what probably our listeners are going to want to know. How do you do that? You know, if I'm working in an office and I see the acts of making the environment very exclusive, and I feel like I'm being, you know, targeted and I'm not a part of the group, how do I make it visible? You know, years ago, and I'm thinking about this example with hand washing, a provider found it insulting if a patient said, can you wash your hands? Or if they asked them, could they wash their hands? You know, now we actually encourage patients to say it. You know, how liberating for people like me who actually want to see their provider wash their hands when we're patients. So what was once awkward and left providers feeling guilty or embarrassed, or, you know, it was almost a blow to their ego, it's now looked upon as, oh, yes, thank you. Like it's a gentle reminder and deemed appropriate. You know, if you didn't see your provider wash their hands, you can assume that it wasn't done. Go ahead and remind him or her, and it's okay. So are we there with bias, or are we moving in that direction?
Okay, so that's beautiful. I love that. I just love that, Kenya. So one of the things that we found is that to make progress, you need to create a safe learning environment for people to learn from mistakes, right? So, you know, so we know that white people are not aware that there are things that they have that others don't. We also know that the term privilege is confusing, so I would say relative privilege, right?
Mm-hmm.
So we know that. And if we're not careful, when we're intervening, we can create a tremendous amount of threat and reaction and then have everything closed down. So the key, just like with hand washing, is to just normalize it, to create a safe learning environment. So one of the things that, you know, I do a lot of talks, I do presentations, I'm a particular person situated in a particular world, right? I'm a white person, I make good money, I'm highly educated. I try very hard in a lot of ways, and I can tell you some of those ways, to not just stay in my bubble, but I'm going to make mistakes, right? You know mm-hmm. it, I know it, I am. I'm going to say things, I'm going to do things, something. So what I love is if someone will call me on it. And it is, I'm so grateful. I'm like, thank you for helping me see. We need to create that environment. You just said that about hand washing. Thank you. That's exactly the way I say it when I do the training. Thank you. Right. Thank you for telling me. So the a lot of the approaches right now are not geared towards creating a safe learning environment. But what we know is when we create a normative safe learning environment where people understand what's happening, there's tremendous change that can occur. I'm very hopeful. So when you just described that, that was perfect. So one of the things that I think people need to do is to find a way to talk about this. You know, let me back up. So it's really devastating. It's really painful. It's really hurtful. You know, it's bad. And so if I say to someone, well, you know, make it easy on the whites to listen to it. It's sort of this concern about white fragility. Why would that be my job, right? Or for me, you know, gender bias is still so terrible in academic medicine. It's being redocumented now. You know, so, oh, I'm supposed to educate the white men. And I get that. The issue is, though, we still need to do that. We still need to create these safe learning environments, because otherwise people are going to just circle the wagons and close down. So that's one piece. So creating visibility, there's a few things. One is helping people put it in context, which is understanding that we don't think or act, we don't think the way we think we think.
Right.
That we're really controlled, like 70% of what we do is controlled by this very rapidly acting part of our brain that is really obsolete. It has high levels of threat. So one thing is, if you take morph images and you change them on a continuum from white looking to black looking. So what that is what I mean by that, it's the same face, and then the computer kind of just morphs it a bit, like from now it's a white person, now it's a black person, but identical face. White people will look at the black man and the white man, and remember, they're identical, they've just been more, and think that the black man is angry and hostile, even though it's just a resting expression.
Right, because what we see, our lens, really is based on our experiences and our prior beliefs.
It's an automatic threat response that is being exacerbated and reified or reinforced by the media and by... I'll give you an example of one of the ways it kind of just perpetuates itself. So, if the language that's being used to describe what black youth do can be somewhat less kind than the language that is used to describe what used to.
And right.
Automatic implicit assumption bias is a negative one. However, as white people, we hear that and it reinforces it.
Oh, definitely.
So we need to interrupt that. That's one thing, right? We need to pay attention to language and interrupt it. I always invite people when they say something to me, I say, okay, sit there a minute. This is a white man. Say it. Oh, you're uncomfortable, right? And again, safe learning environment, I'm not confrontational. I'm like, yeah, you know, I know it's hard. You don't get it. You're surrounded by it. Is that okay? Is that how you describe it? How would you describe it? Right? And so we can interrupt that. And that's at the conscious level, but it does raise awareness. So to create a felt need or awareness for organizations that are big enough, a deep diversity and inclusion assessment that goes below the policies, like are there, you know, do you have a sufficient number of underrepresented minorities on your search committees? Well, maybe, but it doesn't matter if the search committee dynamics. So really deep inclusion assessment. Provide that back to the organization in a safe way so that they will not be threatened by it, that it's going to, right?
Mm-hmm.
Provide more information on, like, big picture on what's really happening and why they, even though they're fabulous, wonderful people with nothing but goodwill, right, may actually be biased. And why is that, right? Now, how does that happen? So that's where you start, but that's not exactly how you fix it. That's how you create openness to learning.
Right. Oh, this is so powerful. This is really powerful. So I before we end, I just want to ask you, because this road to creating a safe environment, we're going to have you come back to talk more on how do we create that road. But just for our listeners, you know, if I'm a patient and I believe that my provider is acting in a way that is biased, how can I safely and without making anyone feel threatened, how can I, as a patient, respond in a way that's acceptable, that's not not accusatory or guilt-provoking or threatening to their ego? What would be one of the best ways that I could respond?
So I'm going to start with prevention, and then I'll answer that question because you know, and again, you shouldn't have to do this, right? But here's what you can do, and it's sad and it hurts me to even describe it. But one of the things that as a patient or anything, whenever you're getting services is, you know, so that but maybe your listeners don't know how distracted doctors are, right?
Mm-hmm.
And how busy they are.
Yes.
And because they're busy, they tend to just over-apply whatever information comes really quickly. So one thing to do is to find a way to get that person to connect with you as a human being. Because what we know is, very brief interventions where you look through the other person's eyes, you imagine yourself in their shoes, perspective taking, you take their perspective for a minute, can derail bias because now this is a human being just like you as opposed to this other. So it's kind of a goal, is see if you can connect, and that's one thing, see if you can connect in some way with this provider in any way, if you can find something that's human about them, or you can sort of tell a story, a funny little story about something, have something, anything. It might not work, right?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying, but it's something you can do. Anything you can do to help that person see you as you, as opposed to in terms of your group category. That's one thing. All right. So once it happens, there's no set answer because each organization is different, right? So there isn't a single answer. You know, one thing that you can do is ask for a different provider. Another thing that you can do is spend a little bit more time talking with them and say, what would you be telling your, for you, right? You go by he, she pronouns?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So you can say, what would you ask your sister to do right now? If this was your sister or this was your mother or daughter or, you know, whatever, what would you be telling her? So again, you bring this person back to, what would I do for my in-group? How would I see it? So I would always ask that. I always ask that question. I actually ask that of anybody who's making any recommendations. Car salesmen, you know, providers, nurses. You know, if I was your sister, if I was your daughter, whatever, if I was your son, whatever, what would you be telling me? What would you want from me? So that's one thing you can do. Now, if you are mistreated, you file a complaint, period, because they need to get out of there.
Right, okay? But you know, sometimes it's very subtle. It's not so you know, apparent.
That's why we have a huge painful problem, because it's usually subtle. So
right.
I would prefer that the physician themselves is doing this work, taking a minute to look through things through your eyes so that they're not being hijacked. But in reality, we know that that's not very realistic. So in the meantime, get them to connect you with someone close to them.
Okay.
Is that helpful?
Oh, it is very helpful. Wow. You know, thank you. First of all, thank you, Michelle, for making this session such a thought-provoking and brain-stretching discussion. You're going to have to come back again to help us move the needle closer to that place where everyone has an opportunity to receive the best possible healthcare encounter. You know, I believe that we can create a safe environment to begin these dialogues and to almost make it like it is to talk about hand washing. Make it safe. You said already, you know, we have to normalize this. And we have to make it humanistic. And I love it that you're using these words, these concepts that are really going to help us, you know, make healthcare better for everyone. I want to thank our listeners for joining us today on Health Styles. And again, thank you, Michelle, for sharing your wisdom about implicit bias, the power of assumptions, and how we can respond to bias during a patient-provider encounter. And I'd like to close with one last thing. We all have assumptions, whether we are doctors, nurses, police officers, or teachers. And how we respond to our assumptions could be so far from what we espouse. But unless we recognize and drive out some of our assumptions, we could really harm the very ones we claim to care about. So join me for my next discussion on the paradigm shift that might be needed to improve the quality of the institutions in which we work, learn, and play. Again, I'm Kenya Beard. Thank you for listening to Health Styles. Michelle, is there anything else you want to leave the listeners with?
Mindfulness, as amazing as this is, 10 minutes of mindfulness seems to lower bias for all of us. There's something about true mindfulness, and I think it's because it slows down the automatic assumptions. It lets you just let them float through. So there's several studies now showing that mindfulness meditation makes people much less likely to be hijacked by biases.
Wow. So we can prevent these biases by 10 minutes of intentional mindfulness. I love it. I love it.
I know. Me too.
It sounds so simple.
Yeah, well, for the longest time, I was pretty skeptical, right, of it. And, you know, and it does get to be a little trendy, but I can see why it works. And now there's enough, you know, I always wait to have enough studies before I bring something up, because nobody needs to hear about it. It's something that then, like, 10 minutes later is, you know, disproved. But there's enough now that I'm pretty convinced that mindful people who practice lots and lots of mindfulness are less likely to be biased in their encounters, less likely to be hijacked by bias. Even people who don't practice it, just an intervention where they were guided through a 10-minute guided imagery, mindfulness imagery kind of thing,
mm-hmm.
Were less biased. And in a core way that I think is very linked to your very first example with the police, less biased in terms of trust. They were much more likely in a financial game or a financial encounter with a white versus black person to show the same level of trust. And these are white people.
Wow.
Cool, isn't it?
Oh, it's amazing. It is amazing. So complicated, yet such a simple act. 10 minutes of being mindful. Thank you again, Michelle. Thank you. And again, you're listening to Health Styles. Thank you for joining us. And I'll see you back here in a month. I'm Kenya Beard. Thank you.
Thank you.